In 1989, when you started offering these workshops right. in Seattle, people were not ready to hear it.
No. I mean, to me, it was so incredible. So, you know, I, as a director of continuing education, you know, wanted to set up courses that would draw people in. So we set up Voluntary Simplicity. 4 signed up, so we had to cancel it. 10 would have been good. Well, it would have been enough. 20 would have been good. 4 wasn't enough. So when we did it again 3 years later in 92, same amount of publicity, and had 175 people show up. It was like, what is happening? And what happened then was, then the local media picked it up and thought, oh, isn't this interesting? What's happening? And then from that, national media, and in fact, the reason I ended up writing the book is because Esquire did an article about Seattle. A book editor from HarperCollins called me to see if I wanted to write a book. Of course, what it was, of course. And so it was like, isn't this? So you'll have people that just sense that something is happening. And Voluntary Simplicity, I realized, really is a lot of different movements from the last 40 years coming together. The part of the women's movement that wants a more balanced society, you know, not just to get in and compete. The environmental movement, the natural health movement, spirituality movement, even I think the movement of people's liberation, you know, for people of color and gays and lesbians and people with disabilities, just to say, I want to be who I am. Because what we're finding is, as people more and more have to work in corporations, they can't be who they are either. It's like they're totally playing a role. And so I think it's this sense of people wanting a real life.
Self-actualization?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, those were the words in the 60s. This is like a movement that goes underground periodically, but it never disappears. And so people are going back now and quoting Maslow. People are, you know, I reread a lot of Eric Fromm that I read in the 60s. And it was, it's the same thing. He said all of this stuff. It's all been said before.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about the media picking up on this, that's very interesting. They picked up on it for a few weeks and then dropped it like a hot potato when it was counter to all the messages that they're staying in business promoting. You know, use this underarm deodorant or else you'll never have sex with pretty people. Or drive, buy this new car or else you'll be looked upon as a chump or whatever message we get. So how does your message, how can it exist in a media that's saying you have to buy, you have to spend, and more to be happy?
This is going to be such a dilemma for the media, because one, the reporters know that this is an interesting subject and people want to hear about it. Advertisers are not going to like it. Nice thing is, Voluntary Simplicity sounds, you know, really benign and sweet, but it really says question everything. We've got to change the direction of the economy, what we buy. So what is the dilemma? That you want to give people what they want to hear, so you'll have listeners. And this is what people want to hear. And at the same time, you've got this other to buy. So, and I haven't really seen the media drop this yet, because there's continued to be, I mean, we've had the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, all these local newspapers, you know, National Public Radio. Everybody has come to this, but it's still, but advertisers are starting to use, buy this, it'll make your life more simple.
Uh-huh.
So that's like, oh God, they're going to take our word away from us.
Uh-huh. Well, they have taken the word away from us, because in the beginning, there was the word.
Mm-hmm.
And that has morphed into late 20th century America as to, we'll be right back after this word.
Oh, God.
So
yes,
they've co-opted
the word
already.
All these good words get co-opted. Liberation, that was a great word. It got taken away. And I really do see this as another one of the liberation movements.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm still stuck on the media, though, because while an occasional newspaper article or an occasional review of a book like yours is something that they'll cover and something that runs counter to why they exist currently, they exist to make money, still we don't see the radio stations or the TV stations with their big push. You know, this is, let's pick the charity of the month and let's give that a lot of time and a lot of support. For example, whether they do a Toys for Tots or give teddy bears to kids at Christmas time, that kind of promotion where they leverage all 100,000 watts behind a particular message, we're not seeing that
yet. you're not going to see that.
Ever?
Right. No, I don't think so. And this is why I really see this as a real people's movement. And this is why I talked about study circles. Because study circles come from Sweden, where in the 19th century, when it was a country with, you know, big gaps between the rich and the poor, they wanted a way to transform society. And it was study circles that they used. And even now, study circles are used. I mean, two-thirds of adults in Sweden are in study circles. It's a way of life of talking about policy issues. The government uses study circles to help citizens form policy. And so this is jumped over here, and it's being used more and more. What I tried to do is to match it up with voluntary simplicity and not be just something you're talking about, but something you're also changing your life about. But this is the way it's going to happen. People getting together and making changes themselves.
And the media then following that parade.
Yeah.
We are out of time, but we have so much more to talk about, so I want to ask you to come back. So we're going to take a break and have you back, and we'll have another discussion. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you,
and
Bob.
Good luck with your work. The book is The Circle of Simplicity, Return to the Good Life, and our guest has been Cecile Andrews. For those who maybe didn't catch the first part of the interview, can you give us a brief definition? We went through this before. It's hard to define, but tell us exactly how you define voluntary simplicity.
Well, one way to define it is that less is more instead of more is better. In this country, we're made to think that if you just have more of everything, you'll be happier. But what that means is you never reach a point where you think, wow, I've got it. It's a guaranteed dissatisfaction. So this is like, you know, how much do I really need?
It's like tobacco. Once you get that, you have a puff and you get that brain kick, it's like, ah, that's nice. But to get that same kind of kick, maybe you need two or three puffs. And before you know it, it's a pack. And before you know it, you're dying of lung cancer because there's not enough tobacco that can fill the hole that you're trying to fill.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of people have compared this. In fact, Philip Slater wrote a book called Wealth Addiction. And it's kind of like when you do go shopping, you do get kind of a rise out of it. I think of it as the Costco high. You know, you go to Costco and you go in and you buy stuff that not only you didn't really need, but things that you didn't even know existed before you went. But it's so cheap that you can't resist.
You can't pass. We've got a pickup truck full of Cheerios and it's only $20. You got to buy it, right?
Exactly. So what do you do when you go out of there? Everybody spends at least $100. And you go home and you have this feeling of, wow. But then it fades. And so the next time you have to go back.
Yeah, and you have to buy more, right?
You have to buy more, exactly.
Because if it didn't work with $100 worth of stuff, it must take $200 and $300 because the commercials on TV keep telling me that if I buy stuff, I'm going to be happy, sexy, and have sex with the good-looking people.
Right.
when we go through the book, we see a lot of themes, you know, and I see this headed into an area where I'm really interested in, and it's all about consciousness is what it is. Mm-hmm. And one of the themes I see in the book and that I resonate with is community or our lack of community. Whereas when I grew up in the early 60s, you know, if I busted somebody's window or if I did something to a neighbor, my father was going to find out about it. But our communities aren't the same. Our sense of community is not the same anymore.
No. And in fact, I don't even think people know what it means. And when you think of how rarely you're with a group of people that you can be absolutely yourself with, that you can say what you want, and you won't have them like looking at you as if you're crazy. And I asked one group of people why it was so hard to say what you wanted to say. And someone said, because you say the wrong thing, that's it. You're cut off. And so we have to have this group, this community, where we can just be ourselves. And somebody will listen to us, talk to us, and we don't have it.
Yeah. And tell us that we're a jerk when we're being a jerk.
Yeah.
And be honest and real about it.
Yeah. And it's okay if they tell you that.
Uh-huh. You talked a little bit in the last part of the interview about study circles. And I get a sense that these study circles are almost voluntary simplicity communities. They're also support groups in a way. Can you tell us about the study circles?
Well, you can read a book, you can go to a workshop, and you can start making changes. But almost all of us then go back to our old ways. I mean, it's hard not to. You have all these pressures to buy, to watch TV. So you get with a group of people, and these are about groups of 6 to 8 people who meet in people's homes, and you talk about how to simplify your lives. And there's this sense that everyone is helping everyone else, that you're not, you know, like pointing a finger like, oh God, you went to Costco this week, you bought that, you know, you're a sinner sort of thing.
You're out of the group.
Exactly. So once again, you're denounced. So, you know, there is this sense that you try things out. At the end of each study circle, you say, okay, this week I'm going to try. It's like you tell the group, I'm going to try this. And then you try it during the week. And if it works, that's great. But you tell people, you say, oh, this week I tried to take the bus, but, you know, that number 16 is the slowest bus in the universe. And somebody else says, well, have you tried, you know, bus number 5? It works much better. Or you say, well, I wanted to have some, you know, friends over, but, you know, it was so chaotic cooking for them. And somebody says, well, look, I've got a simple recipe for you. And so you have people, you know, helping each other out. And so there's never any of this sense that you have to keep up an image. And every place else, we have to keep that image up. Pretend, you know, when I was an administrator, I had to act like an administrator. And, you know, then, but you find these cracks appearing. Pretty soon I noticed instead of wearing nylons, I was wearing black tights. And then the next thing you knew, I'd taken off my little tie. And then instead of carrying a briefcase, I started wearing a backpack, because it was a black leather backpack. But it's like you find people just, you know, don't want to have to, you know, just be a role all the time. And in study circles, you can be yourself.
People are getting sick of playing the game, aren't they?
Yeah. It doesn't, you know, if you don't feel like yourself, you don't really experience anything.
Yeah. We're talking about consumerism perhaps being the antithesis of self-actualization.
Mm-hmm.
Really being the opposite pole.
Exactly. But we're made to think that it is your self-expression. And in fact, we've made consumerism the easiest thing to do. The easiest thing to do is buy something. It's hard to vote. You know, I ask people when I give my workshops, how much singing do you do? How much singing? And people raise their hands, and some people will say, well, I sing in the bathtub or I sing in the car. Nobody's getting together and singing with other people. And they say, oh, well, it's because I'm not a good singer. So somehow they've been made to feel that we're not good at anything. But you can go buy a CD. You can buy something. And so we've lost all of this creativity.
Uh-huh. When you talk to people from our parents' generation about this, my father, a depression baby, I mean, you start talking about this, and he thinks you've just sniffed some kind of glue or something. I mean, do you get that reaction when you talk to people who say, this isn't a movement, this is common sense?
Right, it is common sense. That's what it is. And so it's really nice, because you have a link up with people from the depression generation, and they say, well, that's what we did all of our lives. But in Europe, where there is starting to be some attention to this movement as well, that is what they think, that these Americans are crazy, right? That this is all common sense. But what we're starting to see is that we've gotten way out of balance, that money is like, should be just part of decisions. You know, it's always going to be, but it's taken over everything. That you know, if you're paid enough money, you'll do it. And I mean, I think it's brilliant, this thing with the Goldman, you know, O.J. Simpson. You won't have to pay the money if you'll admit you did it. It's like, this is the American dilemma. You know, how much are you willing to sell yourself for?
Yeah. When do you begin to sell yourself out?
Right.